Hello, this is Sarah popping in your feed to say, did you think that we were done with book clubs here at Pantsuit Politics? False. We spent a lot of time talking about our premium book club available to our Spice Club on Patreon and Apple Podcast subscription. But listen, I maybe had an idea for another book club and everybody lovingly and graciously went along, which is a slow book club because I like to read a book a little bit at a time over the course of a long period. It makes those denser texts easier to take in. And a dense text that has been on my to-be-read list for a long time is Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. And seriously, what better year than a presidential year to read it? So we are making our way slowly through Democracy in America. Beth and I have already discussed part one, and we thought we would share that conversation with you here in the main feed so you could get a taste of what's going on over in our premium community. We hope you enjoy this discussion of part one of Alexis de Tocqueville's seminal text, Democracy in America, that we are slow reading with our premium podcast members.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of More to Say. Today is the first installment in our slow reading long of Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Sarah and I are here together to discuss part one, which really runs the gamut. Everything from the fundamental characteristics of human nature to the risks and benefits of centralized governments, aristocracies, and democracies. It's a smorgasbord of information, and we are here to process it all together. Okay, Sarah, when we said we were going to talk about Democracy in America, some people were like, okay, but how do I even order this? Like, what am I getting? This whole thing? We're going to do this whole thing? What's happening? So let's just start with our why. What interested you in doing this slow read-along of Democracy in America?
Listen, I love a slow read. I like to cover the classics this way. Last year, I listened to The Brothers Karamazov, all 36 hours of it, 6 minutes at a time. On Audible. I just think it's a good way to take in really dense material. And Megan Francis is doing a slow read of the Comfort of Crows. This really great book that's like, you would love it. It's like week by week, just observations in her backyard or about the passing of seasons. And I thought, oh, that would be so fun. And I've wanted to read Democracy in America for so long. And I've like got it on my Kindle, but I needed like a little moving deadline. And as we are talking so much about, in fact, Democracy in America due to the presidential election, I thought, well, this is a great year. This would be a fun year to like read something slow. Listen, our people love book clubs. They love reading and book clubs and deadlines and homework. So I thought this was great. I have to tell you, though, hilariously, I wrote about this on my Substack, and my professor, former political science professor, Don Doogie, who follows all my stuff and is just amazing, but is also a bit of a curmudgeon, wrote me and said, he wrote me about Habits of the Heart, the accompanying thing that Hillary Clinton suggested as we read Democracy in America. And he was like, you read some of that in college, in parentheses, or at least you were assigned it. I was like, oh, touche, Dr. Doogie, touche. I did my reading. Do I strike you as a person who would ignore the reading assignment? Give me a break. I'm making it up for myself as an adult. Of course I did it.
That's the thing, though. All those collegiate texts, I now feel ready to return to.
Yeah, they're wasted on the young, man.
I feel like they're going to mean something much more important and impactful to me now. For me, reading this is just critical, I don't know, self-care as I try to take in all the Trump legal stuff. Because our system is being tested in so many ways that remembering what the system is supposed to be about, it's like a way to keep my eyes on the forest and not just be lost in the trees. And that sounds weird when you talk about a piece that's this dense and long and kind of all over the place, but it still helps me get to the forest.
Well, and I just think what's so interesting about this book as a classic American text is that it was not written for an American audience. Alexis de Tocqueville was French. You know, they were going through the French Revolution. He was a member of the aristocracy, and he was like trying to come back from this wild place called America that everybody was like, what? Everybody in Europe was like, what the heck is going on over there? And he was like, dispatches from the frontier, right? Like, let me just try to decode what I think is what's happening in this very interesting democratic experiment. And I just think it's so interesting that it's become this text that we use as Americans when it was not written to or for us originally.
Yeah, Ellen always wants to know what I'm reading. And so last night she watched me finishing up part one. And she said, what is this? There's an eagle on the cover. What's going on here? And I said, it's just a young, wealthy French dude who came to America very early in the nation's history and spent some time here and went back and said, I have thoughts. I'm going to put them all down.
I have some observations for all of you. Here's my blog before there were blogs. We put it on paper. It's a crazy idea.
So what felt really confirming to me is that this book leads in the way that I feel like I try to lead a lot of More to Say episodes about a different country, where I'm just trying to say, like, let's just talk about how big this place is and who lives there and what the geography is like. Because that strong sense of place is really important. And I love that he began by talking about the importance of language here and how language is a game changer for the United States compared to Europe.
Yeah, I mean, he gets on a lot of stuff we've talked about over and over again. I mean, he talks about the different orientation to sort of civic life in New England versus the South, like very much like Colin Woodard's American Nations that we've talked about, like these sort of different ethnic backgrounds and how they contribute to what they saw as the American experiment. And yeah, he goes on. You've talked about this recently multiple times if we've talked about Ukraine. It's just like, we're just a big ass country. Like, geography is on our side. Although I thought it was so interesting, he was like, you think it would be true for South America too, and it's not, which I thought was sort of interesting. Although South America is not one big country, obviously, not all of North America is, but man, we take up a lot of it. And I just thought it was interesting. He's like, they've just got more room to spread out and try some things geographically.
I loved that. And I loved how he talked about how you see this pronounced difference despite the language. The shared language because of the institution of slavery in the South. I loved how he talked about how slavery dishonors labor, which introduces all kinds of undesirable qualities into society. And I mean, he says in a very French way, the influence of slavery explains the manners and social condition of the Southern states. And you can just hear the judgment the very French judgment permeating those sections of the book.
Which is interesting because it's not like French history is free of slavery. But yeah, I thought the sort of history, I had so many times where I thought, wow, this feels completely current. And so many times where I was like, oh, right, this was written in 1800s. I really liked how he just talked about like everybody's got the right to vote. Like just, you know, everybody. And I'm like, except for women, friend. And he just, it's like, we don't exist. It's like, well, yeah, but all the men have a right to vote. And it's just like, that's everybody, which I thought was a little interesting wake-up call reminder that this was written in the 1800s.
Very big discounting of the indigenous people in the United States. Very big discounting of slavery, other than being critical of its effects on the slave owners. The geographic perspective that was most interesting to me that just kept coming up was like his sense that the oceans would protect America from everything. He was like, you all think you just crushed it in the American Revolution. Greatly exaggerated. You won because of the big ocean. And probably because of the big oceans on either side of you, you're going to have only friends in the world and you're never going to be in wars. Lucky you, a robust foreign policy is not going to be important here. And it was just wild to take that in.
And then at the same time, he ends talking about how this is all going to be about Russia and America.
Yes.
I thought that part, I was like, whoa, y'all, I got to read this part to you. The conquest of the American are therefore gained by the plowshare, those of the Russian by the sword. The principal instrument of the former is freedom, of the latter, servitude. Like, and I just thought, like, how did he see in the 1800s? Because, like, that Russia and America were going to be these two big players presenting different visions of government, of servitude, of just of life. I just wrote, wow. This is how we wrapped up part one, because it's like, yeah, he couldn't conceive of discussions about Russia having perhaps a nuclear weapon shot from space, but he got the Russia part right.
And just the fact that the central human conflict would be, is it better to be governed by one strong leader or to have a government that is a mess of ideas, but people get to vote? And that is the essential conflict. And he called it. Also, I thought it was fascinating to read. He thought eventually there'd be 150 million people in the United States. I was like, good job. That's an excellent projection from then.
Yeah, not that far off, friend.
You know how you learn to really appreciate how good your products are? Leave town and get stuck with whatever shampoo is in the hotel. I take Pros and their custom hair products for granted, y'all. Pros is made for people, not hair and skin types. Personalization is rooted in everything they do. From their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. From millions of possible formulas, only one is uniquely yours or mine. I never found beauty products that really understood my needs. But ever since I switched to custom hair and skin routine with Pros, I've noticed so many benefits. My thin hair is moisturized but not weighed down, and my waves have never looked better. And Pros isn't just better for you, it's better for the planet. They're a certified B Corp, cruelty-free, and the first and only carbon-neutral custom beauty brand. Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/pantsuit. So you get your free consultation, then 50% off at pros.com/pantsuit. That's PROSE.com/pantsuit.
Sarah and I have talked many times about our desire to age as gracefully as possible, and skincare is a huge piece of that. I spend a lot of time and money thinking about my skin, and I have added Ritual to my routine, which just gives me a lot of comfort. Ritual is here for us. They have created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted clinical studies, so we know it's working. They're taking the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual Hyacera is one of several Ritual products that I love. I take the daily multivitamin, I take a probiotic, and Hyacera is that once daily skincare supplement that is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. I recently met a friend for the first time in person as opposed to online, and we were discussing the fact that I am 43, and she said, I cannot believe how young you look, and I thought, thank you, Ritual, for that. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
In previous episodes, I have outed myself as a bed-making fanatic. I am very serious about my bed being an oasis, a gift to Chad and me as we crawl into it at the end of a long day. So I want to return to how much I love my Boll & Branch sheets. With Boll & Branch sheets, you can discover a new level of softness. The sheets are made from 100% organic cotton in a buttery, breathable weave that truly gets softer every time you wash them. And you know that I like to do that once a week, so my Boll & Branch are rapidly aging like a fine wine. The sheets look great. I have them in a beautiful slate color. They stay put, so making my bed is quick and easy. They are a bestseller for a reason. The signature sheets feel incredible on night one. They are loved by millions of sleepers, and they come with a 30-night worry-free guarantee. Sleep better at night with the softest sheets from Boll & Branch. Get 15% off your first order when you use promo code PANTSUIT at BollAndBranch.com. That's Boll & Branch, B-O-L-L-A-N-D, branch.com, promo code PANTSUIT. Exclusions apply. See site for details. Okay, I want to talk about some of the social observations he made first. I love that he talked about, like, the Puritans. You could tell that he was like, what is with these people?
Listen, the Puritans and the French, could you get further apart?
But
you could not.
I think what has made this such a classic is his ability to say at the same time, these people are doing extremely punitive, simplistic, intrusive lawmaking and trying of people. And at the same time, they are advancing liberty in profoundly modern ways. Like, both things are true.
Both things. There's a lot of both things are true. Listen, I think the French are kind of good at that. I'm not going to lie. And so, you know, when he is getting into particularly New England, I thought his observations were so interesting because it's like you have this civic culture, but you have Puritans. I thought it was interesting that he makes the observation that we cite from Hannah Arendt in our book, which is they just liked it. Mm-hmm. They just liked it. They just loved to get together and debate. They just wanted to be together talking about these things, and that it was its own type of control, that was its own type of regulation. I thought it was interesting that he had that whole thing about, like, well, in some ways, freedom of speech is limited because you can say whatever you want, but you really don't want to get out of step with the majority. I thought that part was so interesting.
You know, there were these pages that I just marked as like, this is cancel culture. He's just describing what we spend all our time fighting about in terms of cancel culture. The whole vibe to me was that he's like, these Americans are fascinating because they are definitely not as smart as me and all my friends. Because they have to work. They can't just study and like learn and enjoy things, the finer things in life. They have to work all the time. But they've built all these schools because they want everyone to reach a certain level so that everyone can be part of taking care of the society. And they're so proud of themselves about it. It's almost embarrassing how patriotic they are. But isn't that kind of great, too? And it's just like his ability to look at us like kind of sad little lab rats who have a kind of freedom that he's never enjoyed is just wild to behold.
Yeah, I mean, one of these quotes, I was like, I stopped what I was doing and I said it to all my friends in public education. It says, but it is by the mandates relating to public education that the original character of American civilization is at once placed in the clearest light. Thought that was really good and true and true. Like, it just, we beat up on public education and we just forget that was unheard of. Like, it was something that we built American democracy on, that it wasn't true around the world. I mean, I read that book about Ireland, you know, before I went this summer, and it was like after World War II in Ireland, like, there were not a lot of schools. The children were not being educated at any sort of modern understanding that we have of education.
I think that brings me around to this observation that is a theme in part one, that it's so easy to criticize democracy, to see all of its flaws. Mm-hmm. Its advantages have to be lived to be appreciated. How different a society is when everyone gets a certain level of education. You have to walk in the shoes to get that. And I love how he tried to share it and at the same time acknowledged this is something that you feel when you're here.
And it's just not the same as in Europe.
Well, I do think that it's like it's a very French thing that there's just more comfort with saying it's kind of both, or like the with the gray in life. Like I thought when he said, look, you're not getting a lot with the freedom of press, but you lose a lot if you don't have it. I mean, that's the point Yasha Monk made on our podcast, right? Like, it's just you just if you don't have it, it's worse. We're not saying having it fixes everything, but if you don't have it, this is what you lose. And he articulates that, I think, in so many levels. Like, because he's an outsider, he can say, look, this is not as great as they make it out to be, but if you didn't have it, it would be worse.
Yeah, I loved all of his commentary about how democracy produces worse leaders than aristocracies. Yeah. You just get bozos. That's what I kept thinking about you saying, state legislators filled with bozos.
But listen, that's like parenting. The highs are high and the lows are lows. Like aristocracy, yeah, you can get somebody really great, or you can get somebody truly incompetent. You can't do shit about it.
And that's what he says. You're not getting as good a people, but you don't have them forever. You're not stuck with them. And their interest should always be aligned with the majority. It should work itself out. So I kept reading this sort of tension between centralized government and not, and this beauty of citizens feeling so attached to their government as essential to democracy, and thinking, okay, I don't have the perspective of an outsider the way Alexis de Tocqueville did. Which parts of this would he write differently today? How far or how close to this vision are we today? If a modern Alexis de Tocqueville were here, what would he see about us?
Yeah, there were moments where I thought, are we closer to this or are we farther away? I mean, I read so much about the decentralized administration and the decentralized government and thought, yes, that is what protected us from Donald Trump. Absolutely. Like reading through that part. Post January 6th, you're like, yep, that's where the rubber met the road, and it worked, without a doubt. And I thought that part, he nailed it. But then there were parts like you really have to struggle with where, you know, they were just so comfortable being like, the majority of people are kind of dumb and are going to make dumb decisions sometimes. And you're like, oh, that's so un-American. I don't want to think that way. And also, it's just hard not to feel that way post Donald Trump. It's just hard not to be like, yeah. What do we do when the majority wants bad things? Really, really bad things.
Well, the experience of local government, too, is so uneven across America.
Yeah.
Now. And I don't think that was true when he was here.
Right.
We do have giant cities. You know, he described at one point, like, small nations would really be better. The world would be better if everything was really, really small. But you have to be kind of big because somebody else is going to get big. And what good is all this freedom that you have if someone can just come in and conquer you? So he thinks we're trying to find the right balance here. But local government in New York City or in Chicago or in Atlanta bears no resemblance to local government in Union, Kentucky, where I live now. And my local government in Union, Kentucky bears no resemblance to the local government in Livermore, Kentucky, where I was born and where my parents still live. And so this idea of how attached citizens are to their communities, that the township is the nucleus, I love all that. That's exactly where I started my political journey, and it's a place I find myself returning to often. But I just can't figure out when are we too big for that vision to obtain? Because so many people live in communities and never interact with their local government, at least in a way that they think about and that it inspires that sense of citizenship and responsibility. I do think we have a lot of people in the United States who would classify themselves or would relate more to the idea of being subjects of the government than citizens who are part and parcel of it.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I'm really excited to read The Habits of the Heart and sort of get into that aspect of, I mean, not advice, but sort of to translate what this outsider observed into actions we can take as citizens. I think that part is harder and definitely made more difficult by sort of a nationalized media environment. Although there were just so many parts, even where he was observing the parties, where I thought, yeah. That tracks. That sounds about right. Like the struggles, the limitations, the ways in which they can be sort of occupied by factions, like all that part rang true to me. Like, and I thought, none of this is wrong. What I thought was super interesting, too, is if you're talking about the sort of struggles with modern life and what was he missing, I thought the way he articulate people's like turn from religion, I was like, boy, you wouldn't recognize today. But I thought, well, is that true? Is it true? Or is this just, this is the ever-present refrain? You know, this is what happens a lot in the books you read, like the books I read post-World War Britain. There's a lot of concern about the degrading of culture and the move away from religion and values and morals and ethics. And I think, like, I read that and it's sort of strangely comforting to feel like, no, this is just a pendulum. And that, you know, I told you the other day, I'm really interested in this, like, Mark Wahlberg prayer app and the Savannah Guthrie God book. Like, are we swinging back the other way? Like, I'm super, super interested. But to hear him articulate these sort of modern concerns about society and culture and the way we think about things and prioritize things kind of made me feel weirdly better.
Yeah, there are whole sections of this that read exactly like all the think pieces about how decadent we are.
Yeah.
Like, they don't have big ideas anymore. Since the Federalists burned out, the United States swarm with lesser controversies. Public opinion is divided into 1,000 minute shades of difference upon questions of detail. You know, they don't struggle through the hard stuff. And I was kind of like, preach that good gospel. But also, oh, man, like, this is just get off my lawn, right? It has always been.
Well, and I think that's true. I mean, that's a luxury. You succeed in the bigger questions, so then people don't tackle the bigger questions because you tackled them. It's sort of indicative of your success, right? I do think that there is an aspect of that right now, even sort of post-COVID, you know, this sense of like, we want to struggle. We want to be the greater generation. We want to come together. But the status quo is powerful and we don't really want to be uncomfortable. And so this tension between, you know, progress, the upending of the status quo, the parts where he was naming some of the challenges surrounding aristocracy and how, like, well, they're clearly not in control in America. And I thought, boy, you couldn't sell this piece to many of the progressives who still think that, like, money is the root of all evil in politics. You know, the way he sort of named the way that power exercises and how you couldn't in a democracy, I also thought was really, really interesting and a sort of a good level check, you know, like sort of a good wake up call to we think that there is an aristocracy, an oligarchy in America. But you list as a French guy from the 1800s, like you don't know aristocracy, even Britain.
And at the same time, I think his affection for the Federalists was not only the questions they were asking, it's just the people. He related a lot more to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson than to people who were born here and then decided to, like, uproot and go out west and see what might be out there. The place in the text where he sort of takes a second to focus on the physical beauty around him, where he's like, look at these woods. Like, what kind of person hangs out in these woods all the time? They're intriguing and beautiful, but I can't stay here. So I think there's some unfairness in they don't ask the big questions anymore. We are publishing an episode today about what is a frozen embryo. That's a huge question. When does life begin? And what protections are lives in various stages entitled to? Those are enormous questions. But they are being struggled with by people that de Tocqueville would not have counted among the intellects, right? And I think that that's part of the reason we have some of these big questions that we haven't solved is because they said we had universal suffrage, but there weren't women involved.
Well, now, before we get onto these bigger questions, because I do think the way he talks about freedom and liberty and the way we've smushed those words together in American culture is really interesting. But before, I want to make sure we don't miss his love letter to lawyers. Beth, did you enjoy his love letter to lawyers?
I sent a picture of the love letter to lawyers to one of my old colleagues. I thought it was very interesting. I thought all of his observations about the judiciary were so on point that here's the judiciary that looks and sounds like our judiciaries over here, but is extremely political and extremely involved in everything.
Decades and decades before the political questions get to the Supreme Court, Alexis de Tocqueville was like, stop pretending, you losers. Mm-hmm. Of course they're answering political questions.
And so he says, because the judges are so involved in absolutely everything.
Or elected.
If there is a special social class, if there is an aristocracy here, it's the lawyers. And it's like Fair. A love letter while also saying, like, sucks for you. It totally predicted the resentment of the professional class that has been so important to Donald Trump's ascendance.
Yeah, true. 100%.
That this class of people is going to feel special and work hard and have access to parts of government that no one else does, but they're never really rich. They're never rich the way truly rich people are rich, and they're going to hate that. It's all there.
Yep. Well, speaking of observations of relevant constituencies, he also has a lot to say about zealous Christians. Zealous Christians are still found amongst us. I thought that part was super. The religionists are the enemies of liberty, and the friends of liberty attack religion. The high-minded and the noble advocate bondage, and the meanest and most servile preach independence. Honest and enlightened citizens are opposed to all progress, whilst men without patriotism and without principle put themselves forward as the apostles of civilization and intelligence.
Yeah, the way that he links patriotism and faith are really interesting to me, because it's clear from passages like the one you just read that he would reject Christian nationalism as it exists today, and that he would be firmer on the side of the importance of faith as the bedrock from which you do everything else than the vast majority of our political leaders would be comfortable saying today. It's another one of those both things are true situations, because he like laments the absence of religion, but also laments the extremes of religion.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. You guys, I love my Aura frames. I have one in my office. I have one in my kitchen. I have given one as a housewarming gift. I have given one as Mother's Day, Father's Day. They are the most amazing gifts because this app is a game changer, in my personal opinion, in digital frames. It makes it so, so easy to get the pictures on there and even videos. It plays like you're in Harry Potter, you guys. It is the best. I love mine so much. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So on these like bigger questions, I feel like the biggest question motivating him that he comes back to over and over again is this sort of rule of the majority and what the effect of that is on individual liberty, equality, freedom. And again, I think we use those words interchangeably, where he is very careful to sort of piece them apart. He says, but liberty is not the chief and constant object of their desire. Equality is their idol. They make rapid and sudden efforts to obtain liberty. And if they miss their aim, resign themselves to their disappointment, but nothing can satisfy them without equality, and they would rather perish than lose it.
I think that's really prescient, especially as you think about where we are today. Because another concept that is floating throughout this whole part of the book is order. And he just kind of says, you don't get order in democracy. You got to let order go. Yet here we are fixated in so many ways on order. So many animating dynamics, especially over, like, say, the last 6 to 12 months. Certainly the issues that people wanted to make the last set of elections about. Petty theft, smash and grab retail, order, issues of order. Donald Trump, when he talks in American carnage, it's all order. It's all the stuff that Alexis de Tocqueville would say, well, like, yeah, strongman's better at that. Centralized government does that much better. But you guys also don't want anyone to be over you for any reason. And that's the other animating, that's the anti-elitism. So it's so interesting that Donald Trump has put together these things that de Tocqueville says you can't put together. If you want order, then you got to have elites, and you got to have really strong, empowered elites. And the MAGA movement is, we don't want elites, but we want order. So we just, I guess, just want the one strong man and the elites that he chooses to empower until we don't like them anymore.
Well, I mean, what's the famous Benjamin Franklin quote? Those who would sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither security nor liberty. I think maybe freedom. Because that's the tension, right, in a democratic nation state, which I think they could see more clearly because it was such a new experiment, which is, I think, something we paradoxically can't quite comprehend in America. I think part of this is geography, just like he names, which is, what is a nation state supposed to do? It is supposed to provide security from foreign invaders and safety within its borders, right? Like, we kind of hold up, like, this is what a government is supposed to do. And I don't think that we have or continue to be good at seeing the tension in trying to do that as a democracy, as a majority rule, as a place where you do have to protect the rights of the minority so that they do not have their security and safety threatened. And I think because he was an outsider, he could just see that tension more clearly. I think the founding fathers saw that tension. I think that's why you see sort of the constant conversation around the role of the executive. They're just trying to figure out, like, how do you move quickly and protect people if you have to ask for their permission to do it? And what if what they want is not what keeps them safe? What if what they want is not what keeps things orderly and, you know, even fair? Right? What happens when the majority perpetuates rules that are unfair, that restrict this equality that we're all focused on? There is a tension there. We're dealing with it right now. What happens when the major American party does not value the rule of law? What does that mean? What's more important, democracy or the rule of law? Where are we prioritizing here? And I think that because it was new and because we've lost the perspective of what it's like if, you know, a majority of Europe and the world powers are monarchies, that this is a new thing we're trying to figure out. And it is a constant balancing act. And it's, you're never done.
And we're doing it now on a completely different canvas because we have people whose families have been here for generations. He talks about how being a nation of immigrants was the perfect entree to equality because super happy, wealthy people don't leave their countries of origin. They stay where they are super happy. And he says, like, when you've got people basically living in exile, of course it's easier for them to see one another as equals. Generations down the road, though, we have an entirely different perspective on immigration, right? We're not talking about the southern border saying, gosh, look at all these people here to remind us of the bedrock principle of equality on which this nation was founded. I would just love to know, as we wrap up here, I mean, there's so many directions this conversation could go. And look, it's a slow read along. We could do another one of these if we didn't touch on things in part one that you all want to hear about. But I would love to know, What were the pieces that you think, oh, this is going to change how I view like a current situation we're wrestling with? Is there anything that you're really taking away from part one that you think you're going to apply to modern things immediately?
No, I just think it's comforting. And I think in the same way, you know, it's important to go to church. Hear me out here. Not because I think if you don't go to church, you're going to hell. Because I just think it gives you a ritualistic opportunity to stop and think about what kind of person do I want to be. I just like this ritualistic opportunity to think about what kind of citizen do I want to be and what is government for. Like, I just think that any moment to absent yourself from the torrent of news and crises and events in American life to saying, whoa, what are we doing here? I mean, that's why we like the homework. That's why we liked college. So just sit around, think about the important things in life. Gives us a purpose. It gives us a pursuit. I think that is comforting and gives perspective and gives moments to think about prioritization and to realize that you're not alone and that this is a long experiment, not just in democracy, but in, you know, sort of intellectual curiosity that we're all participating in. And I find that enormously comforting.
I agree with all that. I also have three specific things. So the first thing is that Alexis de Tocqueville very clearly answers one of the big questions we're struggling with right now, where he says the rights granted to the courts of justice of punishing the agents of executive government when they violate the laws is so natural a one that it cannot be looked on as an extraordinary privilege. He answers the question, should Donald Trump have absolute immunity? No.
No.
It's so natural that it's not even extraordinary, Alexis de Tocqueville says. And I think that's helpful and important. I also felt very affirmed in some of my criminal justice radicalism when he talked about how that justice is more efficacious when it is more certain and more mild. That quickly getting to a situation but not overreacting to it is the way that you do keep a just society and a safer society. And the third thing I'm thinking about a lot in terms of current events is his description of war. He described war to me in a way that did not ring true for me as an American. It also felt questionable to me about his own experience as a Frenchman, like at a time when there was like constant revolutions, because he described war as like the most important occurrence in the life of a nation, where people act as one against foreign nations in defense of their very existence. That doesn't sound like what the French would have been experiencing. Right? The French revolutions being prevalent on his mind, it's just weird to me that that's how he described war. And so what does it mean as we think about our big country protected by the oceans, who could have never had any foreign policy, according to this guy, that our experience of war has, even when it's been most present for us, has always been really distant compared to his description and the way that he like frames up what war should mean to a citizenry. So that's something I'm going to be thinking about a lot.
Oh, I thought that made sense. I mean, I just think, you know what I always think about? I just think about the Hundred Year War. I could not tell you who fought the Hundred Year War. I could not tell you what the Hundred Year War was about. All I know is that it was 100 years and they just could not leave each other alone. Like Europe was just, it's very important considering our current debate about NATO. That just for most of European history, they were fighting each other all the time about land and boundaries and wealth and colonialism and just this constant, constant battle. You know, the French Revolution was the exception, not the rule, as far as conflicts across the European continent and what would compose their sort of understanding of the word war. You know, and so I think that part to me is still true. I mean, I think it's NATO has been such a success that has been lessened, right? And I think that's what that's super, super relevant right now.
You know, for us as a nation, as we think about war, we're reformulating what war means for us right now.
Yeah.
President Biden is reformulating how America fights wars. We're fighting them through sanctions. We're fighting them through diplomatic partnerships. We're fighting them through covert action. We're fighting them through retaliatory actions unrelated to central conflicts. Like, it is a new era in terms of what a war means to us, to the point where I don't know that war is the right word anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe it's just conflict.
I don't know that war was the right word in the Persian Gulf. I don't know that war was the right word in Vietnam. Like, there are so many places where even with engaged fighting, if it is happening so remote to the citizenry in a country where the citizen staying connected to government is the essential fiber of being able to preserve democracy. I don't know. I think there are just a bunch of big, hard, and interesting ramifications to that. But I enjoyed it. I didn't think I would enjoy reading Democracy in America. I did enjoy it. I think I'm reading it very, very slowly. I'm glad that we have lots of time with it because I need to stop and think and take a lot of notes. But I think it's been good. And I'm really curious to hear listeners' perspectives on it.
So our next meeting is April 26th. We will be discussing part two, book one. We are reading the Signet classic, edited abridged. Thank you very much, because the original one is quite the beast. So if you want to join us for the next Slow Book Club meetup, it'll be on April 26th.
And if you don't want to read, you just want to come sit in.
That's also allowed.
I hope that this experience was a good one for you today and that you will be up for it again in April. Thank you all so much for being here. Have the best weekend available to you. We'll see you back here next week.